On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with best-selling author and consciousness philosopher Tim Freake.
What's been obvious to me over the last period since finishing my last book, that a new hegemony has arisen in the West. It's in America, it's in the UK over here, and it's a very dead form of science. And it's a bit like I didn't foresee really how fundamentalist religion would come back and hit us between the eyes. And I didn't quite see either that we would end up with this fundamentalist, narrow, literally, as you say, soul-destroying idea, which creates this meaningless idea that we're clever monkeys clinging to a rock hurtling through space on a meaningless journey to nowhere.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sicaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have an interview with Tim Freake, who is quite an interesting guy. You might have heard of one of his many books or his retreats or his many presentations on consciousness and spirituality. Quite an interesting guy. I think you'll enjoy this interview. One thing I wanted to mention, I haven't spoken a lot about this book I've been working on titled Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything, but I have been making progress on it, and this interview is one of the interviews I've included in this book. It actually comes at the end of the book as kind of a wrap-up of where things might be headed with these new ideas about consciousness that we talk so much about on this show. So with that as a little bit of an introduction, let me get right to my interview with Tim Freake. Today we welcome Tim Freake to Skeptico. Tim is one of the most innovative and popular thinkers among the rapidly growing spiritual but not religious crowd, a crowd I have to say I would count myself part of. He's also the author of more than 30 books and the creator of a very intriguing retreat called The Mystery Experience that I hope we'll hear more about. Tim, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure, Alex.
So, you know, in reviewing the body of work that you've amassed, which is really quite impressive and deep in so many, many ways, I feel like there's just so many ways we could go in this interview, so many ways I could take it. And we're going to explore some of those, but I thought we might start with just the basics, and that is your background a little bit and how you came to do what you do.
Well, the basics, I suppose, Alex, is that I found myself alive having this amazing experience and I didn't know what it is. And I wanted to know. And that was what started me off as a child, was this incredible thing was happening, life. And it was great, but it was also painful, and it's everything, the thing we're all experiencing, the thing that's happening right now. And it amazed me that the world I grew up in seemed to ignore it as if it was nothing. And yet to me it seemed profoundly mysterious. And so I set out to study it and to go deep into it. And very soon on, as a 12-year-old, had my first what I call now being deep awake. I didn't know what the hell it was when I was 12. I just had something happened. And it made a big impression on me because it was a complete change of consciousness, characterized by this, well, many things, but by this profound sense of connection with everything and love, this overwhelming embodied feeling of being loved and also being love as well. And it had a huge effect on me and set me off on what became my life. It was like that was the seed. Carl Jung often talks about in people's lives that there's a seminal event when they're young, and that was definitely mine.
Even at that young of an age, you had that strong sense that this was the direction you had to pursue?
Well, I mean, looking back, I mean, you know, it's always hard to tell, isn't it? Because memory is a difficult thing, and I try to be skeptical. That's why I like the name of your program. And I try and hold everything up to go, well, hang on, not so quick. But what's interesting in my case is that I have some documentation, because I had this experience. I was 12 years old. It was a very powerful experience. It was just sitting on a hill overlooking this small town I grew up in. And I did what a Tim Freake does, as it turns out, which is from that I wrote. and I wrote a play. And it was a play called The Wrong Way, and it was about, it was a kind of a modernist go through history. And I produced it with kids, actually, in a local theater in a church. And it was quite a big deal in my hometown. And it was about the figure of Jesus, who I would later write about in a very controversial way, preaching an idea of love, which was obviously fashionable and in the air at the time I was a kid. So it wasn't completely out of the blue. But the last paragraph of this play could have been from one of my books now, and I found it a few years ago in the little box that my mum had kept of all my stuff, and there it was. Oh my goodness, you know, the things, I think I've been on this huge journey, but the thing which I really have ended up writing about was there right from the start when I was 12 or 13.
Oh, please, you have to share. What's that last paragraph?
Well, I don't have it on me, otherwise I would. But the essence of it was, you know, that the thing which I come back to again and again, in most of my books, I think they're all unique. I'm very proud of them in that way. But I think there's something similar, which is they start on a journey from what the hell is going on, this mystery of life. They go through a great philosophical exploration and the different experiences available to us, and usually end up coming right back to the simplicity of what the thing we know, what in the spiritual, I'd now call a gnosis, a deep knowing, the thing we know, the real simple thing is that on a profound level that we're all one, and that what really matters is love, and that what really matters is love has been the thing which has pushed me through all these different twists and turns of my own journey. And it was there right from the start in exactly it's the kind of way that it was expressed reminded me of myself even now.
Yes, there's so many ways we can go even with that point by itself, and that internal sense of knowing and internal sense of unchangedness deep inside of us is something intriguing. But I tell you what, before we go there, I want to jump off in a different direction, because you've touched on this word mystery a couple times, and I thought it'd be fun to kind of examine that deeper and really deconstruct that. And what do you mean by mystery? I think you go very deep into it in various places I've seen. So tell us about the mystery.
You know, Alex, sometimes I think, you know, having written all of these books, some of which are pretty scholarly books as well as inspirational books, but essentially I began to realize that I thought that my role in life was to nip up behind people when they weren't looking and whisper in their ear, "Hey, have you noticed that you don't know what life is?" And a lot of what I do is travel around the country, and usually when I start talking, I'll begin with that. You know, I don't know what this is. This thing is happening right now to me. I don't know what it is.
And that's the mystery.
And you can see immediately that people, and if we do it now, if people listen to me say that and really, really look, we're having this experience. There's these colors and shapes and thoughts and feelings, and we don't know what it is. And as you enter that don't know, consciousness changes. Yeah. And then the mystery is not just the not knowing. The mystery is knowing the mystery. And so therefore, you know, you get people like St. Paul talking about the mystery of God, or the Native Americans, the great mystery, or just about all the traditions, that there's something so direct that you can know it. You have to know it before words, and the isness of the in the Zen tradition, same thing. So what I mean by the mystery is that.
I also like how you contrast it with the non-mystery that we're so used to and so forced upon, if you will. So you talk about reductionist science and how it's all about non-mystery, you know. And I like how you work in this idea of it's just. I mean, that is the ultimate kind of counter to mystery is, oh, no, it's just, or it's evil twin that I like to throw in there. It's not. Well, it's not that. It's not that. It's just this. And talk a little bit about that and talk about.
Yeah, the just word. I really, you know, really struck me exactly what you've just said when I was, because I love science. I love all human knowledge, and I love science. I love its attitude. I love what it shows. I hate reductionism because of this narrowness where it reduces the richness of life to one narrow story. And you can always say, it's just, the birds are singing. No, that's just them. That's just them holding their territory. Well, it is them holding their territory. It's not just that. Or, you know, I've fallen in love. Really? That's just chemicals. You know that, don't you, in your body? Well, it is chemicals, but it's not just chemicals. And it's that seeing that no matter how much we understand of life, when you look at the sunset, it still goes, wow. And that wow is the mystery. And when we lose that, whether it's looking at the world in terms of our understanding of it or just, you know, in our relationships with our lovers, you know, when you lose the mystery, it goes dead on you. And my whole relationship with life feels a bit like that. You know, when it's a lover, and when I lose the mystery, it goes dead on me. I put it in a box. I think I know what it is, and I don't. And I need to remember that for it to stay alive.
Right. But Tim, what about this deep need that we have that all these other folks are tapping into for non-mystery, for certainty, for understanding, right? Because that's what they're really playing on. So in the same way that the scientists are playing on that, the reductionists, and saying, oh, no, it's just. The atheists are playing on it and saying it's not. And the fundamentalist religious people are playing on it and saying, oh, no, it is just this. And then even as you, I think, quite fairly point out, there's even folks in the non-duality community that are playing the other game too and saying, it's not, you know, no, it's not. It can't be more. It can't be a God in the sense that you've thought about it. It must not be that. So what is it about our need for non-mystery, our need for certainty that makes us so susceptible to this line of thinking?
For me, Alex, the key, the very foundation of the philosophy that I've arrived at now, the one that's in my latest books, is what I call a paralogical approach, paralogical thinking, which is a word I coined to capture a tradition which is very, very old, actually, which is to understand that the nature of this mystery, of life that confronts us, is inherently paradoxical. Which means, as the great physicist Niels Bohr said in his idea of complementarity, that to understand the nature of life, we need to see it from two opposite but complementary perspectives at once. And if we don't see it with both eyes, we don't see any depth, if you like. So we need both of these. So, yes, I'm a spokesman for the mystery, but I love words and I love story. And my whole job as a philosopher is to create the best story I can. And I need that. I can't live without a story. If I lived just in the mystery, I would be an amnesiac. I couldn't function. It'd be ridiculous. Even these noises I'm making would have no significance because I would have no memory of language and so on. So I need story, but I don't want to get lost in story. I need not this or that, but both. So for me, it's not that we need to get rid of the story. It needs to be open-ended. We need also the mystery. So we have both at once. And my experience with nearly all of the great questions which I explore is it's usually not this or that. It's both. And my experience of that is I have a real need to find certainty. It's just I don't find that certainty in words. And I don't expect to anymore. I find the certainty, ironically, in the mystery. That's where I come into contact with this thing which in the ancient West was called a gnosis, a deep knowing of something before words. And that's where it feels like I find something I'm sure of. Now, I can't justify that in words. It's a direct experience. But when I feel, for instance, look, what really matters in life is love. I know that. And I can't tell you. Either you go, yeah, I know that too. Or you go, well, that's just sentimental rubbish. It's not something which it's before words. And that's the places I find certainty. In the words, I find theory. And I love theory. I love story, but I don't expect it to hold any certainty. In fact, to be honest with you, Alex, and this is something we've been thinking about just the other day in the shower, was, you know, I find the opposite. I don't know if you get this, but if I really think the universe is a certain way, any theory, if I really think, oh, it really is like that, I actually experience nausea. There's a nausea that comes with it because you think, why is it like that but not like anything else? Do you know what I'm trying to say? There's a kind of, oh, how weird, it should be like that.
You know, I can't say that I personally relate to that, but I do think...
It's just me.
I do think this issue of words and uncertainty is important. And I guess I'd turn it back to this word that's popped up a couple times now, and that's science. And I've heard in your presentations, you do a wonderfully expansive, inclusive, and yet at the same time, discerning deconstruction of our culture and how we deal with these things. And by that, I mean, you're inclusive of science, you're inclusive of religion, but you also deconstruct them. I wonder sometimes if you're a little bit too inclusive of science, too complimentary of, oh, science is so great. And then you make this distinction of, well, there's deep science, and then there's this reductionist materialist science. And this is like a narrow point, but I feel a need to, I want to be able to ask you the questions that really provoke me in a skeptical way kind of thing.
Absolutely. So, well, for me, it's like, you know, science, it depends what we mean. And maybe I haven't made that clear. See, by science, I mean an epistemology. I mean an epistemology which looks at the objective world critically, develops ideas about it, and tests them out.
Well, wonderful. But wait, whenever we say that, whenever we qualify and say, well, when I say science, I mean this. When I say religion, I mean this. I think we're kind of confusing the issue a little bit. Science is science as we know it. Science is science as it works in our culture. And that science is disturbingly, myopically, reductionistic. It's soul-crushing in so many ways. So do we really need to embrace science, or do we need to kind of take a step back and say, we need to kind of clean out the woodshed a little bit here and say that there's some real, real problems, not only theoretically and philosophically, but experimentally with this idea of reductionism, with this idea fundamentally what science is about is that we can really measure things, that we can really be certain about things, like you were saying. And we've known that's not true for ever since, you know, quantum physics and chaos theory and consciousness science, they all point us and say, well, you can't really measure things at all.
That was a fantastic little rant, Alex. I love it. Yes, I agree with you completely. You're probably right. I'm far too polite. And there's been a part of me which is, you know, we went through with my dear friend Peter Gandhi. I wrote a number of books attacking religion for a while. And then I moved on to trying to express philosophy, which was synthesizing deep spirituality, which, as you rightly say, I call deep science. What's been obvious to me over the last period since finishing my last book, I haven't written for a while, is exactly what you're saying, that a new hegemony has arisen in the West. It's in America, it's in the UK over here, and it's a very dead form of science. And it's a bit like I didn't foresee really how fundamentalist religion would come back and hit us between the eyes. And I didn't quite see either that this, because the prophets of science had moved so far on from materialism, because they'd left fundamentalism completely behind, because none of the great quantum physicists were materialists, or, you know, that this was such a dead philosophy, that science would become, that the word, as you rightfully say, would become associated with something it's not, just as religion becomes associated with something it's not, that we would end up with this fundamentalist, narrow, literally, as you say, soul-destroying idea, which creates this meaningless idea that we're clever monkeys clinging to a rock hurtling through space on a meaningless journey to nowhere, where I don't see anything in the findings, in the experimental nature of science, which points to that at all. I think actually what's happened is that a way of investigating the world has been conflated with a philosophical interpretation of that. And the philosophy of reductionism and materialism is dead. It's finished. It doesn't work. And yet somehow that very stupid idea, polite in the past, I'd like to take the opportunity now of not being polite and saying I think it's a complete, I really think it's the job today is to undercut it, because it's in danger of suffocating us.
Wonderful and wonderfully well said. I want you to touch maybe on that last point a little bit, because you are a philosopher, a new kind of philosopher in many ways, but in some ways, to kind of go back to what we were just saying, more of a true philosopher. That goes against what I was just saying about there being this true instance of it. But I like the kind of philosophy that you grow organically from what you've both experienced and blending it with what you know, your gnosis. But we face science, which has declared philosophy obsolete. That we don't need philosophy anymore. What are your thoughts on where philosophy fits in our perspective on the world? Why do we need philosophy?
I presume you're you're referencing Hawkins just the other day saying that
unbelievable. Yes.
Dropped to the ground. It was like, how can such a clever man say something so foolish?
I don't think he's that clever to begin with, but please go on.
Maybe you're right, but he's certainly better at maths than me, and clever in that sense for sure. The role of philosophy, you know, is to, for me, is why I'm attracted to it. It's a meta discipline. It you know, allows you to put your fingers in every pie, because it's really just coming right back to the basics and going, okay, what is it? That's why I say, for me as a philosopher, the question I start with every morning is, you know, what is this? And what should I do about it? These are very childish, simple things. And then all the questions that come from that, like what is science, come from, well, it's a way of trying to answer, what is this? Does it answer it? How does it answer it? What ways does it answer it well? In what ways does it miss what this is? Same with spirituality. And what I'm looking for is a philosophy which can encompass and account for my actual experience. And I want to be able to share that with others to see if it can account for their actual experience. The complication is that everything is paradoxical. So what we need is a philosophy which can embrace paradox. And part of that paradox is what we experience depends on how we look at it. So it's not even there's something which we can look at and go, and now what do you think about it? In the thinking about it, it shapes what we experience. So we're living in a hall of mirrors in that way. Mm-hmm. So it's both confusing but exciting. It allows us to see that we're kind of creating our experience as well as interpreting it.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I heard that Stephen Hawking's quote that philosophy has been obsoleted more or less by science, it just struck me of the prince trying to usurp the king, really. You know, it's like philosophy is the king. Philosophy asks the fundamental questions that we then charged science with. Who am I? Why am I here? So we started with those philosophically, and then we said, okay, science, go pill around over there, see what you can find out. And then the prince rises up and says, oh, no, you know, I am the true king. I mean,
what happened there with him is a fine example of the thing I was trying to say, and maybe it's too subtle a point to really get across, but it seems key, is that what he's done is not notice, and it's a staggering thing, but he hasn't noticed that what he's calling science is a philosophy.
Exactly.
And that by not noticing that, he has therefore made a philosophy the truth, whereas actually it's an interpretation of certain evidence and ideas. And in conflating the two, he's both destroyed science and philosophy.
Yes. Well said. I tell you what, let's switch only slightly, and you've touched on this a little bit, but your latest book, The Mystery Experience, and it ties into this retreat work that you're doing that we want to hear more about. But the other part of that word is experience. What have you found is our experience? What are we experiencing? Because again, we have to look to science. Science says you're not really experiencing anything, but we obviously are. That's an absurd notion. So what is our experience? What fundamentally, what is it?
Yeah, science is great in that. Well, materialist science, let's be clear. That kind of limited thing. Yes, it starts from the premise what exists is the objective world, studies the objective world very, very carefully, comes back with a lot of very interesting things to say, and announces that nothing else exists but the objective world, which is what it started with in the first place. Whereas the rest of us are actually living in this incredible reality where we experience what was used to be called the soul, and what we today call the psyche. In fact, the ancient Greeks also called it psyche. It's an ancient world where there's this inner, a dimension of our reality doesn't exist in space and time in the same way that our bodies do. And that can be explored in just the same way as the physical universe. And it's amazing, although subjective. And that's what spirituality is involved in. And that's really my area of expertise. It's what fascinates me. That's subjectivism. I'm a subjectivist by nature, not an objectivist. And what I've done is explore it. And what I found in there is that if you can change state, and that what you experience depends on what state you're in. And if you can enter these deep awake states, you experience life in a whole different way. And what I like to share with people is the actual experience. And one of the gateways to those deep awake states is noticing how mysterious life is. It's coming out of the story, the words, the knowing, into not knowing. And then there's this profound experience of oneness and love. And what my aim is in the Mystery Experience Retreats, and indeed in my book, is to give people that direct experience so that it's no longer just something which they've read or words or ideas. It's something you're feeling, something you feel so deeply in your body that you can't deny it. The thing about the experience for me is that it feels more real, not less real, than my other experiences. And that's why it has an authority for me. But it can't have an authority for anyone else because they're not feeling it. But it has an authority for me because it is so powerful and so real. And what I want to do is share that power and reality of that experience of connectedness and love, because I find it transforms how we live our lives and how we are with each other.
Tim, what do you think or suspect is the relationship between that feeling of connectedness, that feeling of love, and our day-to-day conscious experience, and I like the way you put this, that arises out of our field of being?
I think it's to do with the paradox of our own identity, that our own identity is marked by paradox, like the wave particle paradox in quantum physics. Our own identity is that we are both a separate particle and we are part of one wave of life, and that the job of spirituality in nearly all of the great traditions has been to wake us up from identification solely with the particle, so that we become conscious that we're not just this separate individual, we are also one with the whole of life. And so the job is to look deep within to find this place before words where there is this profound oneness of being. And that's and see the reality of that. And then it's a bit like, well, the image I use is, it's like then the experience of being of everyday experience becomes more like a lucid dream, where I call it lucid living. And in the same way that when you dream, you can see, look, I'm a person in a dream, but also I'm the dreamer. And in this awakened state, it's comparable. I feel like, oh, I can see I'm Tim, but I'm also, if you like, the dreamer of the dream of life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one with everything.
And I like how you hold on to and help us better understand how we can hold on to the Tim there, you know, that the Tim doesn't have to disappear, that the Tim is a player in the play as well, you know, and an important player, because it's the only perspective, it's the only seat we have in the theater, you know, is the Tim seat.
Yes. Yes.
So talk a little bit about that, because I think so much of, and I don't want to get too far into inside baseball here, but there is a strain of the non-duality, consciousness kind of crowd that wants to kind of suppress in a way the idea of the individual or the importance of the individual in a way that I think is also, in a way, soul crushing to people too. It's like, how do I resolve that with my experience?
Yes, it's the mirror of the materialist fundamentalists. The materialist
fundamentalists.
They reduce it all. They cut it all up into tiny little pieces and go, look, all it is tiny little bits of matter. And the non-dual fundamentalists reduce it all to one big blob where it's all just one thing and it has no color. And what's in the middle is what we actually experience. And for me, it's both. It's not either or, it's both. Is it one? Yes. Is it many? Yes. Which is it? Both. You know, is it a wave? Is it a particle? Both, depending on how you look at it. It's both at once. And that's the beauty of it. And so for me, the personal is not an illusion to be seen through or some horrible ego thing which has to be got rid of. It's great. I mean, I'm meeting you as Alex here. And isn't that wonderful? You're not me. Great. And we can make these funny noises and pass ideas between us, and we can explore the experience of being alive together. But we don't have to get lost in just being separate. We can also have a sense that we are both the universe meeting itself, and those two things coexist, depending on how you look at it. And we don't have to choose one or the other. And that's why this paralogical or both-and philosophy has become the absolute foundation of my way of looking at life.
In the deep nature of that paradox, the self-evident nature of that paradox launches us back into the mystery, right? Because we can't escape that's somehow not only mysterious, but mysterious in a way that is unresolvable. You know, we just don't have the equipment to resolve it. And that's a little bit of, on one hand, if you take it too hard, it's an ego dump. And on the other hand, if you take it, it's just a humility that you can just kind of ease into and say, you know, it's okay. I don't have to figure everything out.
Yeah, well, see, when I talk about, you know, the mystery, the great mystery, or I'm not, for me, when I say life is a mystery in its deepest sense, I don't mean like it's a mystery which we haven't solved yet. Like, is there life on Mars? Well, what we could find out. Yes, right, there is, right. No, there wasn't, whatever. You know, it's not like that sort of mystery. We don't know yet. I mean that the deepest thing which we are confronted with about life and our own nature is a mystery. That's what it is. It's the absolute mystery. That's its nature. Its nature is to be before our ability to think about it, and therefore to speak about it. Therefore, to come into contact with the isness, again, to quote the Zen people, it is a direct experience before all of that, and therefore it is by its very nature unknowable in that way. And my own nature feels like that. What I am can't be known as an object. It can only be known directly as a subject, my own spirit. So therefore, it's before my ideas about who I am. Any idea I have of who I am is an idea. But what I am is before that. So there's a place for both the ideas and the objective experience, and there's this subjective gnosis as well.
Okay, great stuff. There's so many other places we could go with that, but I want to switch gears a little bit before we run out of time. I have to talk about Jesus.
Ah, dear Jesus.
Of course, folks who know your work would know of your groundbreaking book, The Jesus Mysteries, and it's wonderful in so many ways. It's challenging for people that are clinging to certain preconceived ideas of what that history is all about and what they think they know. But at the same time, it can be liberating in that same way. I want to approach it from a slightly different angle. And that is, do you have a vested interest in Jesus existing or not existing? Because I think that's still, even though you've kind of come down pretty firmly in one camp, I think it's somewhat of an open issue historically. Do you have a strong interest preference in it being one way or another?
I don't think we're ever going to resolve it. Certainly not. I don't think you can ever prove that someone didn't exist. Well, maybe you can. I don't know if definite for sure about history is very wide open. I suppose I have a vested interest in the idea that he doesn't exist because I've written 3 or 4 books claiming that he doesn't. And, you know, being right is always nice. but personally, you know, actually, as Tim, I have no vested interest in it whatsoever. I had a very important relationship with my idea of an historical Jesus, and like everyone, my Jesus was very much like me. He had my values. He was like me, but better. And I very nearly became a Franciscan friar twice when I was a young man. I have no desire for there not to be a Jesus. It's more that the studies that Peter Gandy and I ended up doing really imposed that idea on us. And at first it felt like a loss, and then it started to feel like a huge gain. And I started to understand this Gnostic perspective of understanding it as myth, and that it was about my own journey as a human being, and that looking for a real Jesus was like looking for the real Good Samaritan. It was complete red herring.
Okay, but let me probe that, and I don't want to get too far again and too far into inside baseball, but let me probe that from a couple angles. So you have someone like Bart Ehrman, who's an atheist, even though he calls himself an agnostic or something like that. But he comes out and publishes this work, has published several works, and says, hey, yeah, Jesus existed. He was this really kind of minor figure, but there was a figure out there called Jesus. Now, does that matter in your worldview? Or you have somebody like Robert Eisenman. I'm sure you're familiar with his work. I think his work is very strong, his book, James, the Brother of Jesus. And he says, okay, let's forget about Jesus for a minute, and let's look at this guy who we have some pretty good historical evidence for being the brother of Jesus. So if he's the brother of Jesus, then there most likely was some figure out there that was Jesus. So if we attack it from a, not from a Christian kind of perspective, but more from a historical perspective, that's, I should have qualified that more. That's where I'm really coming from. Is there room for there being some historical figure out there that fits the bill?
Well, there's room for it. I'm just not convinced by the evidence for it. I mean, I think it's so flimsy, it just blows over. I think there are, you know, there's three there's three kind of approaches, I think. There's one which just goes, oh, look, you know, takes the mythology to be truth. That's the literalist view. There's those that go, well, most of it is clearly mythology, but there must have been someone underneath there. And that's done by people who don't understand mythology. One of the great problems for a lot of the people who go looking for the real Jesus with an historian atheist hat on is they don't understand Gnosticism. They Right. don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what the experience of Gnosis is. They don't know why they should care about it. They can't understand why people would create these things. So for them, it's incomprehensible. So there must be someone underneath there who's some sort of religious nutter, probably, who is putting these stuff out there. But if you come at it from... And you, as Peter and I do, with a sense that, look, although these people are very different, living in a different time, and one should not project a modern consciousness onto them, nevertheless, they are talking about the same thing that I've been exploring the whole of my life. And they've done it through these stories, which is actually a very modern medium. We do it through stories and films now. I mean, and we don't think twice about it. And once you get that, once you see that this is going on throughout the ancient world, and once you see that the story that they're most interested in is really different versions of the same story, then by Occam's razor, you have to go, right, well, this looks like a myth. It sounds like a myth. It probably is a myth. And you've got a whole load of other Christians going, it's an allegory. It's not to be taken literally. And that's why I say, I compare it to the Good Samaritan. Nobody goes looking for the Good Samaritan. Well, where did he really live, the Good Samaritan? Well, we found the evidence of the Good Samaritan's brother, so there should have been, you know, all of that. Because we go, look, it's a teaching story. There is no Good Samaritan. Well, the whole thing is a teaching story. The whole story from virgin birth to death and resurrection.
Right, but we also have the angle of and again, I think it's so enriching to approach it from the angle that you are, from this spiritual reality angle, because you're right. I think if you approach it from this hardcore atheist perspective, it's a skewed thinking. I mean, it's another form of apologetics where I'm going to work backwards to explain all this unexplainable stuff, and I'm going to try and jam it back into my framework. So I think it's really refreshing to approach it the way that you are. But the one thing I guess I'd throw in there is we have the direct experience, right? So we have currently in our modern day people who have direct experience with Christ consciousness. And if we look at that with the best, I'm going to put in quotes, scientific means that we have some pretty good evidence that, you know, this changes their lives dramatically. They do things differently. That other people notice they're different. And the reports are consistent across cultures, across time. So there is some kind of experience, direct experience with Christ consciousness. And if we roll that back and say these people living 2,000, 3,000, however many years ago, were no less equipped to have that kind of direct experience, well, that throws a whole other angle into it in interpreting this. So it might not just be allegory. It might not be story. It might be also a direct experience that they're reporting on.
I think for sure, Alex. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, if I said there was no Hamlet or King Lear, it would not make Shakespeare any less of a genius. Whoever created these stories, whoever wrote these things, then there was a lot of people, it was done over a long period. This is brilliant. It's beautiful. And these are deep, wise people. And we know, I think, some of the early Gnostics of Valentinus and Basilides and all of these people. These are amazing people, I suspect, doing incredible things. And and they are having Christ consciousness. You know, that's what they're trying to describe, that for sure. Now, the problem we've got, you see, it's turned around for me now. It's like, well, if there was an historical Jesus, then most people should prepare to be disappointed. Because he's not going to be like their Jesus.
Right.
Because he's going to be like somebody else's Jesus. The chance is that my Jesus is the way he really was, you know, and is probably not right. So the Buddhists have a Jesus who's a Buddha. The Hindus have a Jesus who's an avatar. The Quakers have a nice, gentle, pacifist Jesus. The fundamentalists have a fire and brimstone Jesus. The atheists have a political Jesus or a minor religious fruitcake Jesus. Von Daniken has a spaceman Jesus. Right. Yeah, everyone's got their own Jesus.
But what's wrong with that? Maybe that is closer to the truth in some way we don't understand, but it really is closer to the truth.
I think we can understand it, Alex, because once you get that's the whole point, that Jesus, to use Carl Jung's phrase, is an archetype. that he is or what Joseph Campbell called a mask of God, that the whole point of Jesus is he represents your own deepest being. He is a face through which you can relate to the mystery of God, to the thing which has no form. And therefore, the face he will take will be appropriate to you. So that your Jesus looks like that is fine. It shouldn't be the same as my Jesus. And once you're free from this historical figure, you can let Jesus be whatever he is for you. And that will give you an experience of Christ consciousness. And you can relate to it and do all the things that you should do with a mythic being without having to tie it down to, right, so really, what was he like? Because really, what was he like is a complete red herring.
It is and it isn't to me. You know, I live out here in North San Diego County, California, and just a few miles from Yogananda's, the Self-Realization Fellowship. And I always talk to people who have any kind of Christian kind of opinions on this thing. I say, you know, just go get Autobiography of a Yogi, you know, sure, and read the first 30 pages and mm-hmm. now put the Bible, you know, side by side and you go, well, wow, which is harder to believe. It certainly makes the Bible look tame in terms of, you know, here are people in modern day, you know, talking about somebody who died, Yogananda in 1955, but lived, you know, at the turn of the 20th century and had these people around him that were shape-shifting from animal to human, who had lived for hundreds of years. I mean, all this kind of stuff, resurrected from the dead. So
sure.
I'm not sure that I want to close down the possibility of there being more in some way that I don't understand it or can wrap my arms.
I mean, I feel two things with that, Alex. One is I also really don't want to close down that possibility. And I have had and do have experiences, I think, as I think a lot of people do, of that life is very, very miraculous when it wants to be. And I certainly don't want to close that down. I do, however, want to do two things. One is I notice, and this is purely personal, that when I read Yogananda when I was 18, I believed every word. But if I were to read it now, I would be much more circumspect.
Sure.
That I've been around spiritual circles for 40 years now, and I've seen what happens, and I don't take things on authority like I used to.
Sure, but we all have – well, tell me if this isn't the case, but I have from my own very limited personal experience with non-ordinary experiences, stories that – most people would find circumspect, you know.
On the weekend, actually. So,
so there we go. I mean, it's a mystery that we can't really probe in another level.
What that says to me is, look, yes, of course, the ancient world, as all ancient cultures, is full of stories of miracle workers and traveling philosophers, and there could be one called Jesus who was underneath that. And we could also go, maybe there was one called Dionysus who was underneath the myth of Dionysus, and one
sure.
called Attis who was underneath the world of Attis, and one called Mithras who was underneath the myth of Mithras.
Yeah.
And, you know, and maybe there was and maybe there wasn't. But what we do know is that we've got these stories, and that these stories have deep allegorical meaning. And we know that the philosophers, including the Gnostic philosophers, are going, look, that's the point. They're not going, believe in this figure or listen to this man. I mean, the most damning thing, which no one, I think, can answer really, is the earliest documents we have of any Christian documents are the authentic letters of Paul. Many are not authentic letters, but the authentic letters of Paul. And all the ones that are judged to be. They're the earliest talks to me. And none of them tell anything about Jesus. Now, you know, you've been to the Yogananda Center. If you go to one of those things, what's the first thing everyone goes? Oh, Yogananda said this. He did that. Well, he always said this. Or I was with him once and this happened. We don't have any of that.
Right.
Nothing. Nothing at all. Complete silence. What we get is that you die and resurrect with Christ. And that the Christ is in you. And that is the essential Gnostic message, that this is a dying and resurrecting allegory, which you make this journey and you yourself discover the Christ within you.
Okay, good enough. Let's.
But I don't know. That's important to add. I don't know. I'm completely wrong.
Well, you know, let's shift gears in a little bit of time we have left. Tell us more about this retreat, the mystery experience, and why you went experiential with it, why you touched on that, why you felt there was a need to do that, but tell us more about that.
Well, my real passion, Alex, is experience. you know, my real passion is to be in the oneness and the love with myself and with others. And everything else arises from that. That is the thing which is my life started. This life, you know, when I was 12, I described it to you, and it's been with me and developing and in and out of it ever since. So, and what I've discovered is a way of doing that, an approach to the philosophy of awakening, and actually some practices as well, very, very, very simple, which I can use in a way that doesn't set me up as some sort of special person, which I hate all of that, which means people can come together as fellow explorers of life and have, over a weekend, an incredibly profound experience. I would hope that the vast majority, if not everyone who comes, has this experience so powerfully they can feel it right down into their body. And then they know. And that will change how life unfolds from that point on. It doesn't mean they'll always be in that state, or that, you know, suddenly it'll always be sunny days and never rainy, always yummy and never yucky or anything crazy like that. Of course not. Life will unfold in all of its paradox as it always does. But something is known. And my real calling, the thing which really resonates deep in my heart, is to do that. And now I get the chance. I mean, I'm hoping, I'm just arranging actually a trip to America. I'm hoping for maybe the end of this year, 2014, or early 2015. So my hope is, you know, if people want to experience it, you know, they need to check me out, check out the website, and see that this is available, because I am pretty confident now, having done it all over the world with so many people, that most people will be able to get this for themselves. So it's not just a secondhand tale. It's a firsthand experience.
And the website is The Mystery Experience.
TheMysteryExperience.com, or if you Google Tim Freak, it's such a crazy name, but spelled F-R-E-K-E. They can find me, and there's lots of videos there. And there's our Mystery Experience film, which is a beautiful little 5-minute film, which I made with a filmmaker in the UK to try and convey something of the feeling of this awakening. The how natural it is, how available to all of us it is, and how it feels.
It's very nicely done video. What books would you point people to that are maybe hearing you for the first time or dipping into this for the first time?
Well, my latest, The Mystery Experience, I think is a great place to actually start, because it's where I've ended up, and I try to make everything I do fresh and accessible. It takes you on a journey through the philosophy and practice that I'm exploring into the mystery and back into everyday life. And if it's more the Jesus stuff, which you're thinking, well, that's intriguing. Well, there's a whole series of books, but it starts, as you said, Alex, with the Jesus Mysteries, which is probably as good a place as any to start.
Great. Again, our guest has been Tim Freak. It's an amazing body of work. I do hope you explore it if you're at all interested. Tim, thanks again for joining me.
It's been a real, real pleasure.
Thanks again to Tim Freak for joining me today on Skeptico. And I have one question to tee up from this interview, and it has to do with the discussion Tim and I had about science and how forgiving and understanding one should be about science as we know it versus how critical of a stance we might take. So I think I expounded on that enough in the interview. So I'll leave it to you to take it from there. But tell me your thoughts. Tell me what you think, positive or negative, as always. The place to do it is either at the comment section of the website or at the Skeptical Forum. You can find both at skeptiko.com. Of course, you'll also find all our previous shows available for free download and an email and a Facebook link to me. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I really, really do. I can't wait to get them all to you. And I have some other projects that I'm working on that I hope to announce in the not too distant future. So more coming. Stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.